Thank you. Well, I feel honored to join your beautiful Sangha here. I've been hearing about it from Gil for many years. This morning, I'd like to share with you some of the Dharma lessons I learned in the process of writing this book, Already Home. I took on a kind of interesting task of getting to know my home terrain, the neighborhood where I live in Berkeley, California. And I explored it deeply back through geologic time. I studied the shell mound that had been in my neighborhood only a few blocks from my house for about 5,000 years. And I studied the Victorian settlement that led into the Ocean View neighborhood where I live. And in the process, I also studied my own mind. I was interested when the gentleman before talked about the center cleaning that you have, that it ends up being a thorough cleaning inside and out. Well, that's kind of what I went through in writing this book. It was a deep cleaning of the mind as I explored the place. And there was a lot I learned about my mind and the mind. And one of my many Dharma consultants as I was working on the book was Gil. And later when I'm telling you about the particular story which came to mind this morning, I'll read you some of the passages where I talk about my consultants with him. Whenever my buttons were pushed, and they were pushed often, not only because I'm a mom and now I have a teenager, but also just in learning about the lives of the people in my neighborhood, I tried to put it in a Dharma perspective, and I'd often turn to Gil and also to Ajahn Amaro, who many of you may know. I know Ajahn Sundara was here meeting with you recently, and she's one of the nuns at Amaravati, at Vyagiri with Ajahn Amaro. Okay. So why did I do this? You know, why did I take on a task like this over the past 8 years? Well, it was prompted by the diagnosis of breast cancer. I had a five-year-old, a husband, and I wasn't very old, and I was really scared that I was going to die young and leave my daughter without a mother, and that I would, you know, that I didn't know what to do. So I started walking. I started walking in the hills in Berkeley where I live, and I started walking in my neighborhood. And as I walked, I tried to train myself to see my own life as an expression of this much broader terrain. And it was exceedingly comforting to me and healing to remind myself that, you know, whatever happened with me, if I died within the next few years or not, that this broader terrain would continue, that the hills would be there, the wildflowers, the creeks, and later when I really got into the nitty-gritty of my neighborhood, the train would still come with its call in the morning. I lived down by the bay in Berkeley near the freeway. Some of you may know the 4th Street neighborhood. You know, that the factories would still, you know, be there sending out their fumes, that the neighbors would still be yelling in the street, that there was something ongoing which would continue. And I loved that practice, and it led me to want to study that vast impermanence, to study the history, the geological formation of the bay and the hills, to study the history of the shell mound, and to study the history of my particular corner. This was a Victorian settlement, the first one in the East Bay, with the miners were coming back from the gold fields, and many of them came to this settlement, Ocean View. So I live in a Victorian house. It was built in 1894. And I began with my house and began to study, you know, to try to find out. And I'm not an historian, so I had to consult with a lot of people to learn how to learn. But I went to the Berkeley Architectural Heritage and to the Bancroft Library, and I studied old tax records. I began to find maps where it would show, you know, who owned the different plots and when they began to own those plots. And then through that, I got the names of some of the people who lived on my corner. That led me to the Bureau of Vital Statistics. Now, I don't know if any of you know what a Bureau of Vital Statistics is, but for me, it was a kind of Dharma way station. That's the only way I can describe it. I'll see if I can find my description of it. But this is where people come to get the pieces of paper, which they fill in when somebody is born and also when somebody dies. And this Bureau of Vital Statistics also houses all of these old, you know, death certificates and birth certificates. So I went there to see if I could find the death certificates of my broader neighborhood family, of this, of the people who, you know, were my neighborhood ancestors. Now, you've probably known a lot of people. In fact, many of you may have studied the history of your personal ancestors. Well, this was not something which I thought would be healing at all for me. I came from a family where all the stories that I heard about my family were told in a kind of a jaundiced tone about, you know, family satyrs where, you know, one half of the family met with the other half of the family, you know, for, you know, 20 years and they never spoke. You know, I heard about, you know, divorces and, you know, feuds between, you know, brothers and sisters, you know, all kinds of tales, which to me, you know, felt I didn't want to go any further with any of that stuff. So I thought maybe, you know, if I studied the history of this Victorian family, you know, I would tap into, you know, the family that I had always wanted to have. You know, I pictured in our house the hearth would be roaring and there would be grandparents and cousins and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters, you know, and great, you know, family dinners and Christmases and, you know, all the things that, all of my yearnings in a certain sense at this time when I was feeling that I wanted a sense of home and stability, I began to put into this this idea of my neighborhood family. So here I was researching that, and the phone rang. Okay, and let's see. I was researching that, and I went to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I'm just going to read you briefly. I don't know how many of you have read Heart of Darkness. Probably some of you did in the old days. But when I went to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, I thought of the beginning of Conrad's Heart of Darkness, when there are these two, you know, old lady fates who are sitting knitting. And it's kind of like the entrance to the underworld. And I had that feeling whenever I went to this place where there were all these families, you know, who were getting their either their birth certificates or their death certificates assigned. All right, let's see. A sign over the counter reads, Vital Statistics, Birth and Death Certificates. In the waiting area facing the counter sits a line of people of various colors and ethnicities, many young parents leaning over strollers and holding babies, two darkly dressed women, one middle-aged, her arm around her bent and wrinkled mother. On the counter, two piles of forms prominently displayed under shiny red notices balance one another. One says, birth certificates, $12, and the other, death certificates, $8. That kind of tickled me. Anyone who delves into local history, as I do, must pass through this Bureau of Vital Statistics, which seems to me, as I survey my compatriots, like a special way station for the life cycle. So here I was at the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I had a name. Well, I had a couple of names, but the name I was most interested was Frederick Ophie, because I thought and I had heard that he was a sea captain and he had built my house. And in fact, I'd heard that he had built the house next door and many of the houses in the whole Ocean View settlement. And I don't know if any of you have ever studied local history, but if you look at what preceded phone books, which are called city directories, they have little details about people's lives. It would be as if you opened the phone book and could find out what color people's eyes were, or what job they had, or who they not only, you know, or what, you know, who they stopped being married to, or whether their wife had died that year. So I had found Frederick Ophie, carpenter, and I knew that he was a builder himself. So here I was asking for Frederick Ophie. And I went in, and I waited a long time and paid my $8, and I requested his death certificate, which they didn't have. But they said, we do have an Ophie here. Maybe you'd like to look at this. Well, this was Annie Ophie, and it turned out Annie Ophie was his wife. And the way a death certificate is set up, there's one column which has all the little statistics about somebody's life, you know, who their parents were. She was born in Hanover, Germany, various details of that kind. And the second column has the details of their death. Turning to the right column, I see it's signed informant F. Ophie. This column focuses on the death itself. I begin to decipher the script. It's hard to make out the principal cause. Nephritis interstitial, some kidney disorder, I think. Other contributing causes of importance in bold cursive. There's one word. Exhaustion. Exhaustion. My lip quivers. For just that second, I sense this woman, Annie Ophie, born in Hanover, Germany, housewife, married to a Finnish carpenter, I surmise, for more than 50 years, living in the house on the corner of Dover and H, offering all she had, even more than that, managing marriage, children, a house, just to live. I feel it too, just to protect our own. Always touches me. Just to protect our own, to carry out the simple tasks of life. I don't know why. I didn't expect it would touch me this much this time, but it just brought up for me all the women that I've ever known, my own mom, my grandmother, all of your moms and grandmothers and the grandmothers before that, just trying to make do. Life is really hard. It's hard, and lots of times, I don't know if you felt this way, but I felt like I could die of exhaustion, and I'm only 57 years old. You know, it's tough, you know, and this was one of the first Dharma lessons, because I saw, and I think I talked some with Gil about this too, that, you know, a lot of that exhaustion we can't do anything about. I mean, we have bodies, and there's only so much we can do, and those bodies are wearing out, you know, whether or not we have cancer. You know, but then there's another part of that exhaustion, you know, and I began to think a lot more about that. Let's see if I have that here. Oh, yeah, beyond the exhaustion, and this is where the Buddhism comes in. I bet you've been waiting for that. Okay. When is she going to get to the Buddhism? I mean, we don't want to hear about this history stuff. Okay. Beyond the exhaustion from everyday survival, I notice something extra. It's a weariness from so many battles within my own mind to make my family, my workmates, my friends, my neighbors into something other than what they are. Even this house, I won't go into that because you didn't hear about that, but this is extra, the exhaustion of looking for something outside of what it is. Basic Buddhism, yes, but quite a trick. So that began to be part of the quest, you know, what can I let go of? You know, what parts of this exhaustion that I experience, you know, is extra, is, you know, some kind of fight I'm having on a, you know, moment-to-moment basis with my own experience. We all go through that. And the lessons that that I had around that continued as I continued to study the history of the neighborhood, and as I continued to find these death certificates. And I just want to share one more death certificate with you because it led into further Dharma insights that were really important to me and perhaps touch you in some way as well. I kept going back to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I said, you know, you've got to have Frederick Ophi in there somewhere. You know, I've seen his name. You know, I live in his house. I had the sense that in that back room, you know, they just had to have this thing, you know, and all right, you know, the lady, and she was getting sick of my $8 checks, and, you know, and she was a little wary because I wasn't a blood relative after all. You know, I was just some person who said I wanted to know about my people who lived in my house. So she went back to the back room, and she did, in fact, find another Ophi. But it wasn't, it was not Frederick. It was William Hans Ophi. And I thought, well, maybe it's his brother. Maybe I'll gain some insight into this family. So I asked if I could... if I could see that too. Let me find this for you. Okay, I have a few more minutes here. All right, well, I'll tell you quickly. He died at 35 years old, and his father was the one who had signed his death certificate. And I began to get a little bit uncomfortable because I felt like I was probing into something which in some ways, you know, wasn't my business at all. Father, Fred Ophi. Mother, Annie Benning. I went through that side. Date of death, March 16, 1913. Age 32 years, 11 months, 28 days. The clerks are turning off more lights, straightening up their desks. Hurriedly, I read down the second column. Cause of death, bullet wound in the brain. Then several lines down in parentheses, suicide. A shudder of responses, nausea, excitement, shame. Now I've got the real dirt, I think, the stuff of fiction. And in the next breath, I'm afraid I shouldn't know this. I've gone too far. So I got really quite a comeuppance. Here I was looking for a neighborhood family that, you know, neighborhood ancestors who would, you know, reassure me that it's possible to have, you know, this happy family with the hearth roaring and everybody getting along and just one little scratch below the surface. And I had the mother who died of exhaustion and the son who committed suicide. So this was one of the times that I called, that I called Gil. All right. Okay. As I try to understand, okay, oh, no, that's not the part. Okay, let's see. Okay. As I mull over the yearnings for safety, the drive to protect, I think of the Buddhist teachings on refuge. In Buddhism, taking refuge is said to offer another kind of safety. A student takes refuge as an initiation to the path of practice. This is refuge in the awakened mind, the Buddha, in the truth of the way things are, the Dharma, in one's community, the Sangha. But as I try to understand refuge as safety, I balk. Safety from what? Certainly not from exhaustion, accident, or carcinoma in the right breast. These are some of the people I've found. Talk about refuge, and I know you've all studied refuge. Feels like a trick to me, along the lines of that other trick, the one that I began to understand as a child that I continued to unmask. It's the promise that those older and wiser than myself would take care of me, that everything would be all right, that there would be a happy ending. So in taking refuge as a student of Buddhism, sometimes I feel as if I'm going along with a false promise in which I can't put my trust. So I call up Gil. I call up a favorite meditation teacher, Gil, and ask, isn't it said in Buddhism that taking refuge offers a kind of safe home? I don't see how anything could possibly offer safety. He says, and you've probably heard him say that, of course, it's not the conventional safety. It's not that all kinds of painful things won't happen in your life. He pauses. But if you live your life in such a way that it's an expression of refuge, of your innate goodness, you know that you're not going to add any suffering on top of that. In a sense, the safety is from yourself. I love that. I think of all my own habits of mind, of the anger, denial, reaction, projection, all the fantasies I've had about my perfect home, and I thought serious mind training would indeed be required to protect me from my own mind. So I kept on going, and it wasn't until maybe a month later that I found the obituaries for some of the people who lived in the house, and I finally found the obituary for this young man, William Hans. And at the end of the obituary, it described in detail how he committed suicide. It said, it's been rumored among close friends of Ophi that he was despondent over disappointment in a love affair. It said that he was jilted a short time ago by a young woman he expected to marry. So once again, I went to Gil and I talked to him. And I said, isn't that what Dharma practice might offer? A sense that no matter what comes one's way, nothing, even tremendous loss, is unbearable? And he replies, it's not so much a matter of how we can manage to bear whatever it is. It's a matter of learning which burdens we can put down. What's extra? Beautiful. So talking to him, I realized something, that really this assignment that I had given myself to learn about my neighborhood ancestors and go to the houses of my neighborhood ancestors to learn was kind of like the assignment that the Buddha gave to the woman in the mustard seed story. I'm just curious, how many of you know the mustard seed story? Probably most of you. I'll just remind you a little bit. But a woman at the time of the Buddha has great grief, tremendous grief, because she's lost her only son, and she's carrying him in her arms everywhere. She refuses to go to the burning grounds. And she keeps going up to every healer she can find and saying, please, please, find me some medicine so I can bring my son back to life. Finally, she comes and she finds the Buddha and she says, please, can't you help me? Can't you bring my son back to life? And he says, tell you what, I have a task for you. please go to every house in the village. And in those houses, I'm sure they must have a mustard seed. So you ask, you say, if in this house no one has ever died, if in this house no one has ever experienced suffering, could you please give me a mustard seed? Well, of course, by the end of the time, she had found no house where there hadn't been suffering, where there hadn't been death. And she understood, and she took her son to burning grounds. And, you know, I realized in many ways I was like that woman. You know, I was like that woman. I was carrying the burden. You know, Gil had talked to me about the burdens we carry. I was carrying the burden of my fears of dying and cancer, of my fears of life. I was carrying the burden of all the fantasies and yearnings I had for the perfect family and all the dissatisfactions that I had, you know, with my own family. You know, when I recognized that, it was exceedingly healing. And do I have a few more minutes? I think I probably have a few more minutes before opening this up to questions. I'll just read you one last recognition that I had, which was really quite important to me. Standing here in the briefest of glimpses, I sense an intimacy self to self, a rawness open to the history of this corner. The fathers and mothers, the grandfathers and grandmothers, to the history of this terrain, and now harsh and fresh, even to my own family, that blood lineage with its feuds and heartaches, a family making do like any other. Okay. So I'd like to give you a chance to talk or ask questions. I'm happy to talk about the journey I went on in the neighborhood, or, you know, if you prefer, I'm happy to talk to you about Inquiring Mind, the history of that, and share ideas, hear your ideas about that.
Could you tell us just a little bit of the history of Inquiring Mind?
Of course. Let's see. You know Joseph Goldstein, okay. Well, 20 years ago, he approached Wes Nisker, who you probably also know, they had gone way back to the time when they both studied with Goenka in India. And so Wes was really Joseph's Dharma brother, and he asked him to start a newsletter for the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. And Wes, who knew me from around and about in Berkeley, we both sat together, said that he didn't want to start Inquiring Mind without somebody else, and he wanted it to be me. And so that was that. We started it, and I know we had a number of months when we were trying to think up a title, and at one, I think it was going to be Insight Out, but then it turned out, and that there was a prison, you know, there was some kind of prison network, or, you know, that already had that title. And I think it was Joseph who really liked Inquiring Mind. Actually, I talked to Wes about this before I came today. I thought I had thought up the name Inquiring Mind, but he set me straight, and he said, "No, it was Joseph." So I'll tell you, it was Joseph. Anyway, so we started with a little tiny journal. It looked like this. And the first one had an interview with Joseph, and the second one with Jack. And the third one, I think we had Sharon Salzberg, and Ruth Dennison was in one of the early ones. And we included a list of all the retreats that were being offered in the United States, Vipassana retreats, and they just took up like a half a page. This was 1984. And we ran Inquiring Mind on a Donna basis. For the first number of years, Wes and I paid ourselves 50 $50 for each issue. It came out twice a year. And then we finally got a business manager who helped us get things together a little bit more so we could pay ourselves a little bit more than that. And it's now our 20th anniversary. So I don't know whether you all, you know, have seen copies, but there are some over there. And anybody who's interested in the old moldy ones, if you're not allergic to this old paper, can take a look at some of those.
And she's donating them to the library, so they will be available in our library. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you have perhaps a summary of the key articles in them? That would be a wonderful book to have.
Yeah. You know, actually, this is something that... It's interesting you mention that because I don't know if anybody in this room has talked about this with Gil, but Gil has asked me if we'd be willing to consider having a book of key interviews and articles for Inquiring Mind as a, you know, maybe a Sati Center publication. And he said that there were some people who were very knowledgeable in publishing in the Sangha who might be interested in this. So. This is something which is an ongoing conversation. We do have a website, and you can see descriptions of what all the different main articles are in each issue. And in the back of each issue, there's a description of what's, you know, at least the titles of all the back issues, the themes. But there's more detail than that on the web.
Are the articles on the website?
No, they're not.
It
would be a problem for us, because we really do depend on Donna to have it, and we don't want to use credit cards and all of that to have the articles on the website. Yeah.
Where did you find your inspiration
to begin this? Inquiring Mind? Well, you know what?
At
that time, you know, Wes and I were both very serious practitioners. He wasn't a teacher yet. But he'd been practicing probably since, I don't know if it was the early, sometime in the 60s. And I'd been practicing since 1975. And I wasn't married. I didn't get married till I was 40. So I really, you know, dedicated a tremendous amount of time and went on three-month retreats and other long retreats to practice the Dharma. And I had always been a writer and an editor. So I couldn't imagine anything that I would rather do than start a newspaper of this kind. I was a high school teacher, which I did for 20 years in the classroom. So for the first number of years of working on Inquiring Mind, I would get up at 4 in the morning and, you know, finish correcting my papers and call Wes, who was on the news at KFOG, and do a little planning and then go and teach and then come back and do some more. So it was the love of the Dharma. And, I mean, can you imagine, if you're an editor, anything more amazing than editing the words of these wise masters? I mean, I've edited the words of the Dalai Lama, because I edited the book The Art of Happiness, which some of you may know. I've edited the words of, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, Goenkaji, Gary Snyder, Ann Waldman, you know, Ajahn Amro, Gil Fronsdale, you know, all of these people. In a way, you have to channel somebody if you're going to do a good job, you know, editing their words. So in a certain sense, for me, a major part, and I'm sure for Wes and for anybody who works on Inquiring Mind or any of the Buddhist journals, a great part of one's Dharma practice is in the editing, is in the writing, because you have to try to understand the teachings in order to clarify the words of the teachers as an editor. It's a good question. Yeah.
In your talk, the part where you asked about bearing a burden and spoke with Gil, that really resonated with me. And I was wondering if the conversation ever went on, because I get that. I need to put down some burden.
Mm-hmm.
But he said the real issue is which one. So. Mm-hmm. The process of figuring out which one, and the process, even if I know which one, the process
yeah.
of actually putting it down.
That's a beautiful question. Well, I think this is where the meditation practice really comes in, you know, because when when you're really still and quiet, you begin to see what some of those burdens are, you know, and just recognizing, just recognizing, oh, what a yearning I have for the perfect family, let's say, or the perfect home. Just that recognition is a beginning of letting go of that burden, you know, and so, you know, the exploration I went on, and the explorations all of you go on in your daily lives, are always, you know, in conversation with the exploration you're on, you know, in your sitting practice. And, you know, when you're still, some of that, you begin to see what those burdens are. I don't think you can make yourself let go of anything. But just seeing it deeply, you know, sometimes it loosens a little bit and perhaps dissolves.
Yeah. How is your health?
Thank you so much. Where's some wood or something? So far, so good. You know, I always get scared, you know, when I have I just had the blood test a few days ago, and I always get scared. And I'm sure probably in this room there are many people who have cancer or have had cancer. You know, it's always going to be that way when you have some life-threatening disease. But I've been incredibly blessed and lucky, and I'm fine. I think I'm fine. Fine enough. Thanks. Yeah.
I'm interested in, after doing this research and all that sort of brought you to, is there a way to speak to how differently now, or ways in which you can recognize and articulate how you live in that home, in that neighborhood, which you sort of walk?
Well, you know, another really good question. I'm hoping, I don't know if it's always, certainly not always true, but I'm hoping that I approach my life and my own foibles and problems with much more of a sense of humor. You know, because when you take that vast view of the places where you live, particularly for me, I did a lot of research into the whole geological formation of California and the area, then our little troubles, you know, seem, they're put in a very different perspective. So one thing, I hope that I bring more sense of humor to myself. But then, you know, it's not only that. I hope that as I've gotten to know the neighborhood where I live, that I attend to it with more care. You know, I've gotten to know, I'm hoping, you know, that this book will not just be kind of read as a memoir, but as a kind of mentoring for other people. You know, how many neighbors, I mean, I don't know in this room, but how many neighbors do you know? Do you know their names? You know, I'm going to be leading already home workshops and classes. You know, how many people, you know, could you tomorrow learn one more name of someone in your neighborhood? How about who lived in your apartment or your house? Do you know who lived there before you? What do you know about these people? Who might know something about these people? Can you ask, you know, who's your neighborhood elder? Who's lived in your neighborhood longer than you? Who could teach you about that? I'm hoping that people will, you know, open up to those places where they live. Do you know the names of the trees in your yard or the birds outside your window? Where does your water come from? Where does your garbage go? I went and meditated at the dump. That was an experience. Yeah, I meditated on the graves of the people who had, on Frederick Ophi and his wife and son's grave. I sat and meditated on that grave a number of times. You know, how much connection can you all bring to, you know, finding the connections in your lives to the place where you live? You know, so I guess that's what I've gotten from it, you know, is, you know, a sense of connection and care. I learned a lot about the... I live in a factory neighborhood, and probably not very many of you do live in factory neighborhoods. But there are toxic emissions in my neighborhood. So I got involved with, you know, neighborhood groups who are attending to that. You know, and I did a lot of research about that, and I'm interested in the relationship between cancer and other, you know, immune system diseases and the toxics in the environment. So I'm hoping that other people, when they pay attention to the places where they live, when they pay attention to their neighborhoods and learn about them, will begin to take responsibility for those places. You know, and that's what I've begun to do.
And now people will learn about it.
Yeah, well, I hope so. So, yeah.
Did you find any living Hufis?
I sure tried to. And I had a really interesting experience, actually. I didn't find Ophis, but one of the Ophis married somebody whose name I can't remember this second, but I, Wertman, somebody, Edna Wertman. And I found Wertmans in the phone book in El Cerrito, and I called up this woman, and it turned out she didn't know any Ophis, but she was a practitioner. She was a Vipassana student. So that was, you know, how people talk about 6 degrees of separation. That was amazing. So, and also in the process of doing this book, I started a neighborhood sitting group. And so, and we met in the basement of what was Ophi's, what was formerly the original Ophi house, which was next door to me. And that was pretty amazing. And I'm sure, you know, probably others of you have neighborhood sitting groups, but I never had. But it turned out, as I learned about my neighbors, that there were a lot of meditators right in my neighborhood. And this is in a very mixed, you know, not very affluent neighborhood in Berkeley, not in the hills, but in the flatlands. And right on my block, there were, you know, quite a few people who were interested in meditation, some Zen, Vipassana, yoga students. And we began to sit together. So that was another benefit of getting to know people on my block, create a sangha. I think it's time. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.